Robert C. Freeman is Assistant Professor of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University. He joined the faculty here in 1996 after working 11 years in the church educational system in California and Arizona. Since coming to BYU, he has taught courses in Doctrine and Covenants, LDS Church History, and Living Prophets. A native of Colorado Springs, Brother Freeman began his college education at Ricks College. After serving a full-time mission to London, England, he continued his university studies at BYU, graduating in 1985 with a Bachelor of Science degree in Geology. In 1989, he completed his studies for a law degree at Western State University in Fullerton, California. He is now a member of both the Arizona and Utah state bars. Brother Freeman's involvement in the legal field has included service on the Governor's Regulatory Review Council in Arizona. Professor Freeman has served as co-editor of three volumes of Regional Studies in LDS Church History and has authored several articles on such varied topics as colonization along the Little Colorado, the work of stake presidents in California, the teachings of the Apostle Paul, and of course the Nauvoo Temple. In addition, he has authored 7 articles for the Book of Mormon Reference Companion, 11 articles for the LDS Church History Encyclopedia. Brother Freeman and a colleague, Professor Dennis Wright, are now working with hundreds of LDS veterans and their families to preserve the experiences of LDS servicemen during World Wars I and II. Brother Freeman married Janiel Bacon in the Arizona Temple in 1985, and the couple are the parents of 5 children. They're expecting number 6 sometime near Thanksgiving. The family now resides in Linden, Utah. In the church, Brother Freeman now serves as bishop of the BYU 193rd Ward. We live in a remarkable day, brothers and sisters, in a time when the full blessings of the restored gospel are reaching to every land and people. President Gordon B. Hinckley is now leading the church out of obscurity and out of darkness. The almost miraculous spread of temples throughout the earth not only causes us to look ahead to a bright future, but also to reflect seriously and appreciatively to the past, to a day when the early Latter-day Saints built temples before they built church houses. Fundamental to what we know and foundational to all we do in temples today is the Nauvoo Temple. The announcement by a living prophet in 1999 that the Nauvoo Temple would be rebuilt thus turns the hearts of the children back to our pioneer fathers and mothers, back to a time when the people of the covenant consecrated their souls and surrendered their means so that the house of the Lord could be built, and in order that the blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob could be bestowed and enjoyed once again. We're pleased to listen now to Professor Robert C. Freeman, who will help us to reconstruct this important legacy. Brother Freeman.
Thank you, Dean Millett. Just being introduced by you is reward enough for accepting this assignment. In the Church of the Restoration, a church which rose out of the darkness of the ages, many illuminated days have transpired, and many more are promised. A dawn after nightfall, a restoration of all that is in heaven. Such is the story of the Nauvoo Temple. This beautiful temple rose out of days of trouble and hardship. As it came to be, however, it stood as a beacon of light to the world. Then came the night of darkness, and the temple was no more. This is the story of the Nauvoo Temple. Its beautiful day of birth, its tragic death, and its incredible restoration. Today is a new dawn is emerging and casting its glorious rays on the waters of the Mississippi. As early as August 31st of 1840, the prophet Joseph Smith counseled the saints to give attention to building a temple in Nauvoo. The time has now come when it is necessary to erect a house of order, a house for the worship of our God, where the ordinances can be attended to agreeably to His divine will. During the October 1840 General Conference of the Church, a proposal was unanimously accepted that a temple committee was formed with Reynolds Calhoun, Alpheus Cutler, and Elias Higbee assigned to serve as committee members. That same fall, a site overlooking the Mississippi River was chosen for the temple. Soon afterwards, the Lord instructed his saints in January of 1841, "I command you again to build a house to my name, even in this place, that you may prove yourselves unto me that you are faithful in all things whatsoever I command you, that I may bless you and crown you with honor, immortality, and eternal life." The Nauvoo Temple was the second to be built in this dispensation, the first having been dedicated 5 years previously in Kirtland, Ohio. In many ways, the architecture of the Nauvoo Temple was patterned after the Kirtland Temple, only on a grander scale. A young New England convert by the name of William Weeks, whose early sketches of the future temple matched the vision of the edifice shown Joseph Smith, was selected to be the chief architect for the building. In February of 1841, ground was broken, and on the 8th of April of that same year, the cornerstones were laid for the sanctuary. Work on the new temple had begun. During the four-year period of temple construction, thousands of church members dedicated themselves to building the holy edifice. Many of those who labored on the temple were recent converts to the church who had immigrated to Nauvoo from Great Britain and Europe. In addition to the payment of tithes, each able-bodied man was expected to donate 1 day in 10 to working on the structure. Laborers of every kind were employed, including architects, stone cutters, masons, woodworkers, artisans, and painters. Beyond the borders of Nauvoo, men were also found working in church-operated sawmills of Wisconsin, where lumber for the temple was cut and floated down the Mississippi River to Nauvoo. The sisters, too, contributed to the building of the house of the Lord by making clothes and providing meals for the workmen. They also made and sold quilts and other goods to assist in meeting the building costs. Under the Relief Society, a penny fund was established, which paid for the nails and glass that were used in the temple. Progress on the temple advanced rapidly, and on the 8th of November, 1841, the baptismal font was dedicated for use by Brigham Young. However, work on the temple did not move forward without outside opposition. Throughout the 1840s, storm clouds of persecution gathered as those opposed to the latter-day work increased in strength and number. By the spring of 1844, strained relations between members of the church and their neighbors had reached a fever pitch, and on June 27th, violence erupted in nearby Carthage. The prophet Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram were murdered by a lawless mob. The community of Nauvoo was left in shock. Although work on the temple was briefly suspended after the death of the prophet, construction resumed on July 7th and intensified during the months that followed. Although the saints realized that the remainder of their time in Nauvoo was to be brief, they committed themselves to finishing the temple, not only to fulfill their obligation to the Lord, but also as a tribute to their fallen leaders. In October of 1845, church members gathered in the unfinished temple for the first general conference to be convened in 2.5 years. Approximately 5,000 members attended the proceedings and listened as leaders instructed the saints about details of the exodus planned for the following spring. At the same time, leaders admonished church members to finish the temple. Brigham Young challenged the saints, "I would rather pay out every cent to build up this place and receive an endowment, even were I driven the next minute without anything to take." In the weeks that followed, members continued to contribute not only their time and talents, but also furniture, rugs, plants, mirrors, and other furnishings needed to ready the temple for operation. On the 30th of November, 1845, the attic and other portions of the upper level of the temple were dedicated for use, and 10 days later, on December 10th, the first endowments for the endowments were administered. Ironically, that same day, a meeting was convened between members of the Quorum of the Twelve and two leaders from the Catholic Church, Fathers Tucker and Hamilton. Relations between the Latter-day Saints and the Catholics in the region were generally positive, and leaders from both churches explored the possibility of the Catholic Church purchasing the temple or leasing it and other Nauvoo properties after the departure of the saints. In the end, the meetings proved to be unfruitful. Interestingly, other efforts towards selling or leasing the temple were actually initiated that previous September. On January 2nd, 1845, and in the attic of the temple, Brigham Young prophesied to a group of assembled saints, "We can't stay in this temple but a little while. We have got to build another house. It will be a larger house and a more glorious one. And we shall build a great many houses. And we shall come back here. We shall go to Kirtland and build houses all over the continent of North America." Brigham Young's prophecy soon saw its fulfillment. External pressures from outsiders increased through the winter. At the same time, efforts to administer the endowment to members of the church intensified, with the temple operating virtually round the clock. Even after Brigham Young directed that temple work should be suspended, the temple was quickly reopened in order to satisfy the appeals from members who desired to be endowed. On February 4th, 1846, the first wave of wagons began to roll westward from the city. For the second time in their young history, the Latter-day Saints were leaving behind a beautiful temple. Typical of the descriptions of the saints' departure from Nauvoo is that of church member Lewis Barney. On reaching the summit between the Mississippi and Des Moines rivers, the company made a halt for the purpose of taking a last and peering look at the Nauvoo Temple, the spire of which was then glittering in the bright sun. The last view of the temple was witnessed amidst the sighs and lamentations, all faces in gloom and sorrow, bathed in tears at being forced from our homes and temple that had cost so much toil and suffering to complete. Among the saints left behind were Almon Babbitt, John Fulmer, and Joseph Haywood, who had been assigned several weeks earlier to remain in Nauvoo. They had been called to act as agents for the church in negotiating the sale or lease of various church properties, including the temple. Only 5 days after the first wagons left Nauvoo, and at approximately 3:30 in the afternoon, fire was seen rising from the temple roof. Apostle Willard Richards, who was at the temple site, quickly organized a bucket brigade, and within half an hour, the fire was extinguished, causing only minor damage. It was later learned that the fire was not caused by church enemies, as was first supposed, but rather by a stovepipe, which ignited clothes drying in an attic room. Brigham Young, who saw the fire from a distance and arrived at the temple block only after the fire was extinguished, calmly declared, "If it is the will of the Lord that the temple be burned instead of being defiled by the Gentiles, amen to it." Damage to the roof was soon repaired, and those remaining in Nauvoo continued work on the temple. Finally, on April 30th, the temple was dedicated in a private ceremony presided over by Orson Hyde. Also in attendance were leaders Wilford Woodruff, Joseph Young, and William W. Phelps. Over the next several days, public dedication service sessions were also conducted, the last of which was held on May 3rd. While the sacred edifice was arguably never entirely finished, the temple was fully functional. In the holy edifice, several key ordinances were offered for the first time in a Latter-day temple, and approximately 5,600 individuals received their temple endowment. Just 2 weeks after the temple was dedicated, an advertisement appeared in the local Hancock Eagle newspaper, which read, temple for sale. The undersigned trustees of the Latter-day Saints propose to sell the temple on very low terms. If an early application is made, the temple is admirably designed for literary and religious purposes. Address the undersigned trustees, Almon Babbitt, Joseph Haywood, and John Fulmer. The sanctuary had cost between $800,000 and $1 million to erect. Leaders had hoped that the sale of the edifice to a qualified buyer would help defray some of the expenses incurred during the move west. Even for many non-Latter-day Saints, the building was valued and regarded as a thing of beauty. One visitor to the temple described its beauty as follows. The immense audience chamber, with its pews and changing backs, its immense altars and oratories, its gorgeous tapestry and moats in gold and silver, its ponderous chandeliers and innumerable columns and frescoes, bewilder the eye with their gorgeous beauty. Notwithstanding the elegance of the building, several obstacles impeded efforts to sell the temple. The greatest hurdle for potential buyers may have been the uncertainty of the intentions of the lawless contingent in Hancock County toward the temple. Threats of unlawful activity continued through the summer and into the tumultuous fall of 1846. During the month of September, a week-long battle for the control of Nauvoo erupted as the few hundred remaining Latter-day Saints were attacked by a mob of approximately 1,500. Most of the beleaguered saints fled Nauvoo, and in the aftermath of the Battle of Nauvoo, the temple was occupied by anti-Mormon forces who desecrated the sacred refuge. The mob, in fact, used the building as an operations center until the 20th of October. During the spring of 1847, the trustees resumed their efforts to dispose of the temple. In mid-March, Almon Babbitt embarked on a two-week mission to the East Coast soliciting prospective buyers. The journey proved to be unproductive, and upon his return to Nauvoo, Babbitt wrote to Brigham Young, informing him of the lack of serious interest in the sacred edifice. At the same time, Babbitt expressed his desire to join the saints in the West. Brigham Young's response to Babbitt's correspondence evidences the further frustration which he felt about the situation in Nauvoo. Has the Lord turned bankrupt? Or are his children so needy that they are obliged to sell their father's house for a morsel of bread? In short, Brigham Young's response essentially signaled an end to efforts to sell the temple. While modest efforts to sell a variety of church assets continued into the winter, by March of 1848, the temple was deeded by Almon Babbitt to David T. LeBaron, his brother-in-law, for just $5,000. The church received, just as it happened in Kirtland, the church received virtually nothing for their beloved temple. On October 9th, 1848, approximately 2 years after the last major wave of saints left Nauvoo, fire was again seen rising from the temple. The scene was described by a local newspaper. The fire presented a most sublime spectacle. It commenced in the cupola, and as the flames shot up into the sky, they threw a lurid glare into the surrounding darkness. Great volumes of smoke and flame burst from the windows, and the crash of the falling timbers was distinctly heard on the opposite side of the river. The interior of the building was like a furnace. The walls of solid masonry were heated throughout and cracked by the intense heat. The melted zinc and lead were dropping from its huge blocks during the day. On Tuesday morning, the walls were too hot to be touched. The fire was doubtless the result of arson, the most likely perpetrator being an avowed anti-Mormon by the name of Joseph Agnew, although he was never charged with the crime. By morning, the temple was virtually destroyed, with only the west-facing wall and parts of several others left standing. Gone were the beautiful windows, the exquisite hand-carved woodwork, and many other creations of the saints. When Brigham Young learned that the temple had been burned down, he commented, "I hoped to see it burned before I left, but I did not. I was glad when I heard of its being destroyed by fire and the walls having fallen in, and said, Hell, you cannot now occupy it. On 15th of March, 1849, the Icarians, a religious communal group of nearly 300 individuals, came to Nauvoo. Their leader, a Frenchman by the name of Antony Cabot, had learned of the saint's departure from Nauvoo and sought to occupy the vacant city. Assisted by local citizens, the Icarians purchased the temple block in April of 1849, including the charred remains of the temple and various other properties, for $2,000. At the time, only four partially standing walls were all that was left of the temple. Soon afterward, in the spring of 1850, the Icarians commenced efforts to build a structure upon the foundation of that original temple. Plans changed abruptly, however, for on May 27th, a tornado struck the site and inflicted one final surge of destruction upon the structure. In describing the terrible event, the St. Louis-based Daily Missouri Republican recorded, "The masons were laying in the interior the bases of the pillars when this frightful hurricane, the most terrible experienced in the country in many years, burst suddenly on the hill of Nauvoo, where lightnings, thunder, wind, hail, and rain seemed untied to assail the building. The devastation caused by the storm was complete and effectively terminated all plans to build a significant structure on the temple site. The Icarians did, however, eventually build several buildings on the temple block. The most notable of these was a school made almost entirely of stones from the temple. The Icarians remained in Nauvoo until the fall of 1856, when the group disbanded and scattered to both St. Louis, Missouri, and Corning, Iowa. Following the departure of the Icarians, use of the temple block changed significantly. Over time, the site was divided into several parcels, and numerous businesses were established on the block. Summarizing the uses of the temple block over the next several decades, church historian Andrew Jensen observed, "In the many years that followed, the temple block was occupied by saloons, slaughterhouses, hotels, grocery stores and drug stores, pool halls, a telephone exchange, and private houses. Eventually, most of the property upon which the original temple rested, known generally as the Charles W. Rimwald Estate, was conveyed to the Bank of Nauvoo. Many years passed, and in 1937, the bank contacted church member Wilford Wood, an avid collector of LDS artifacts, and an agent of the church in the purchase of several historical sites. The bank informed Wood that an auction for their portion of the temple block had been scheduled. This was the first and perhaps the most remarkable opportunity for the church to participate in the reacquisition of the temple block. Wood immediately inquired about the interest of the church in the property. He was invited to act as an agent for the church at the auction, but with specific instructions that no more than $1,000 should be offered for the property. Wilford Wood and a traveling companion by the name of Jack Smith drove 1,200 miles from Salt Lake City to Nauvoo. On the morning of February 19th, 1937, both men made their way to the temple block. It was a rainy, overcast morning, but the spirits of both men were buoyant. After inspecting the site, they went to meet with officials of the Bank of Nauvoo. When bank officials learned of the modest intentions of the church, they informed Wood that $1,000 was only the beginning price for the auction and that the final bid was expected to be far in excess of that amount. Seeing that Wood was frustrated by their response, a recess was called for. After the break, Wilford Wood again pleaded for a reduced offer, but apparently to no avail. Brother Wood then explained what happened next. "An impression came over me, and I said, 'Are you going to try to make us pay an exorbitant price for the blood of a martyred prophet, when you know that this property rightfully belongs to the Mormon people?' I felt the spirit of the prophet Joseph in that room. Mr. Anton, the banker, said, "We will sell the lot for $900. I grasped his hand, and then the hand of the cashier of the bank, and an agreement was made and signed. The formal sale was concluded the next day, February 20th, 1837. After Wilfred Wood tendered $900 to the Bank of Nauvoo, a certificate of purchase was made out in the name of the church, and shortly after, Wilfred Wood delivered the document to Presidents Heber J. Grant and David O. McKay. I think that image describes that conveyance. I believe present here somewhere in the audience today, or at least one of Brother Wood's grandchildren, and pleased to have them with us. For the first time in nearly 90 years, the church once again owned a significant portion of the Nauvoo Temple block. 2 months later, on the 19th of April, 1937, Wilfred Wood purchased a second parcel amounting to nearly a quarter of the original temple block. These, along with five other lots from the original temple block, were eventually purchased and delivered by Wood to the church, the last being secured in 1951. Other temple block purchases would follow, including a parcel which was obtained from the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in a land exchange during 1962. At the same time that the church was reclaiming lands that it had formerly owned, other developments were taking shape. In response to the creative vision of church member Dr. J. Leroy Kimball, the church established the Nauvoo Restoration Incorporated, NRI, in 1962 with Brother Kimball assigned to be its first president. The NRI was created to, quote, acquire, restore, protect, and preserve for the education and benefit of its members and the public an understanding and appreciation of the story of Nauvoo, end quote. Over the several decades that followed, important research and archaeological excavations were conducted. These studies would later become of great assistance to architects who would plan the rebuilding of the temple. Independent of events taking shape in and around Nauvoo, other threads of the Nauvoo miracle were being woven into place in places far removed from Illinois. In 1946, exactly 100 years after the Saints left Nauvoo, a young missionary by the name of Easton Blake was tracting without purse or script in Boren, California. He later recalled the following experience. "We went out to tract one night. It got late, and we couldn't find a place to stay. Finally, we saw a light in the distance and decided to stop and see if that family would put us up for the night. It was a porch light, but when we got to it, there was no one at home. Finally, a car came down the road. We introduced ourselves, and the family let us spend the night. The next morning, the husband said, 'Elder Blake, would you please come back sometime?' I said I would, and I went on about my mission. In about a month, I returned to this place. Stayed the night, and the next morning after breakfast, the man escorted me into the dining room. He brought out a roll of plans, and he spread them on the dining table. He said, 'Can you read plans?' I said I could read them. I had had some experience in construction. He said, 'My grandfather was the chief architect of the Nauvoo Temple.' I looked over the plans. They were brown, sepias, not blueprints like today, on thin paper. There were at least three or four pages, quite large. He gave me the plans and said, 'I want these to get to the president of the church.' Arrangements were made, and soon the church was in possession of the plans again. Little did those involved in that experience at the time know that 50 years later, these same plans would be heavily relied on by architects as they planned the exterior and interior design of a new temple for Nauvoo. I'm pleased to acknowledge that present here with us today are Brother and Sister Blake, and they're in the audience here. A second and more recent experience was also helpful in capturing the details of the exterior of the original temple. In June of 1997, Scott Christensen, an archivist with the LDS Historical Department, was attending a professional meeting in Cedar City, Utah. While at the conference, he assisted in hosting a reception at the Iron Mission Museum of the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers. At one point during the event, he was attracted to what looked like a small mirror in a beautiful walnut frame hanging somewhat inconspicuously on a wall. Upon closer inspection, he realized the image was a rare daguerreotype of the Nauvoo Temple. This daguerreotype was different from the few others that had been previously identified, in that it more clearly and fully reveals intimate details of the exterior of the building. With the cooperation of the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers, arrangements were made to meticulously restore the image, which has since served as the most important photographic image for the design of the new temple exterior. The timing of the discovery of this daguerreotype could not have been better, given that the new temple was announced just weeks after the restoration efforts were completed. Pleased to acknowledge that somewhere present here in our auditorium this morning is Brother Christensen, who found that daguerreotype. Many of those present today will recall the unforgettable moment when, during the last session of the April 1999 General Conference of the Church, President Gordon B. Hinckley announced during his closing address, "I feel impressed to announce that among all the temples we are constructing, we plan to build the Nauvoo Temple." At the sound of this announcement, a rush of emotion swept through the congregation assembled in the Salt Lake Tabernacle as well as in LDS congregations gathered around the world. In many ways, the announcement served as an exclamation point for the progress in temple building over the last several years. The news was heralded with great excitement by those assembled in the Nauvoo Stake Center during the conference session. Nauvoo Stake President Durrell N. Nelson related, "There was a moment of shock, and then there was actually applause, even though it was the closing session of conference. Then everyone caught themselves, and for the rest of the meeting, there was crying." While exciting, the call to rebuild the temple has provided church architects and others with an awesome challenge. How can the Nauvoo Temple be built today exactly as it was in the 1840s? The answer, quite simply, is that it cannot. Furthermore, this is not the Lord's intent. While careful efforts have been and are continuing to be made to capture the beauty and grandeur of the original edifice, the uses of temples in our day have expanded so that there will necessarily be differences in the interior appearance and function of the building. In summary, the objective today is not to rebuild the same temple that stood in Nauvoo during the 1840s, but rather to build a modern temple in the same spot as the original. Many are curious about details of the new temple's design and construction. I would like to thank the Temple Construction Department, and particularly their representative Bob Dewey, who is present with us here today with his wife Ida Lou, and Roger Jackson of the architectural firm of FFKR, for some of the updates on current progress on the temple. You'll see before you an architectural rendering of the temple as it is projected. I might just mention, regards to Brother Dewey, he's recently retired from the church construction department after many years of superb service. He currently serves in a voluntary capacity as the Nauvoo Temple project administrator. His service exemplifies the kind of volunteer spirit which marked the original temple and which President Hinckley has encouraged in the present day effort. Many individuals are donating their time, materials, and expertise to the rebuilding project. Before you, yes, is an image of the Nauvoo Temple as it appears today. And this is a live feed. We're indebted to Deseret Book and their camera in Nauvoo.com for providing us this image. The exterior of the temple, you can see, is well above the ground level, and that is the progress as of the last 2 minutes, I think. The exterior of the finished temple will look almost exactly like the original temple, with a notable exception being that the limestone will likely be lighter than that of the original temple. This is because limestone will not be taken from the original Nauvoo quarries, as they are now underwater. It should be noted that the Nauvoo temple will not be a small temple. For example, whereas recent smaller temples such as the Anchorage and Monticello temples are 6,800 square feet in size, the Nauvoo temple will be approximately 50,000 square feet, having the same dimensions as the original temple. The new temple will contain four ordinance rooms with beautiful murals in each. There will be additionally some rooms that were not in the original temple, including a bride's room, dressing rooms, a lunch room, and laundry facilities. The exterior of the temple will have a working clock, like the original, which will face out in all four directions. Specific questions about the temple have included, will there be sunstones? The answer is a resounding yes. As with the original temple, there will also be moonstones and starstones as well. On the exterior of the temple are 30 pilasters or columns. Each will contain a moonstone and a sunstone. Additionally, just as with the original temple, starstones will be placed above each column. While the time involved in creating each of these stones will be far less than that required in the original building, thanks to modern laser technology and cutting machinery, they will look virtually identical to those which graced the exterior of the first temple. A second issue of great interest relates to the Nauvoo Temple Bell, which hung briefly in the belfry of the original temple. That temple was taken from Nauvoo at the time of the Exodus and transported by the saints to Salt Lake Valley, where it arrived in the fall of 1847. The determination has recently been made to return the historic Nauvoo Bell back to Illinois and have it placed in the belfry of the new temple, so that it can once again be observed by those who come to this place. One other item of significant interest is that of the angel Moroni. As can be observed in this early sketch, the original temple had a reclining angel on a weather vane. Just what became of that original angel is somewhat of a mystery. The current question is whether the new temple will have a horizontal or vertical angel Moroni. As most of us are aware, only vertical angels stand atop our existing temples. At present, however, in keeping with the appearance of the original temple, plans call for a reclining angel to be atop the new temple, though this decision is subject to change. It should be noted that progress in the temple has not proceeded without obstacles. Some of you may remember just a few weeks ago, rainstorm deluged the Nauvoo area and caused a great deal of inconvenience in the progress. Additionally, such issues as parking are not fully resolved. Some of the citizens in Nauvoo have voiced concerns about the increased influx of people to Nauvoo. During the summer of 1999 alone, tourism in Nauvoo jumped 25% over the previous year. Church leaders, including President Hinckley himself, have sought to ease fears of growth by assuring the people of Nauvoo that the church will exercise great care in how it grows in the area and will work hard to be a good neighbor. On a positive note, the influx of visitors to Nauvoo has stimulated the local economy. If current plans hold, this magnificent temple will be dedicated sometime in the fall of 2001 or perhaps the spring of 2002. The image before our view is a rough architectural sketch by Canadian artist Bill Ross, how the temple will look. I might add that this audience is the first to see this image. The event will be a great one, and we look forward to President Hinckley being present to dedicate that temple, and pray that he will be able to do so. This will certainly be a singular spiritual event. One interesting note from history is that President Hinckley's father, Bryant Hinckley, was also actively involved in the restoration of the Nauvoo Temple of Nauvoo and in laying the groundwork for a temple to be rebuilt in that sacred place. In 1939, while serving as president of the Northern States Mission, he presided over a centennial celebration service commemorating the founding of Nauvoo. The event was held on the temple lot. During the proceedings, non-Latter-day Saint Lane Newberry spoke of his hope that the temple would someday be rebuilt in full size on the spot where it once stood. Bryant Hinckley likewise shared in that dream, though it was not to be fulfilled in his day. The Nauvoo Temple is not the first temple in the history of the world to be rebuilt, nor will it be the last. Solomon's Temple was destroyed by the Babylonians and was rebuilt some 70 years later. Furthermore, ancient and modern prophets have foretold that the temple in Jerusalem will be rebuilt before the Son of God returns in his glory. Sunrise, sunset, and sunrise again on the Mississippi. The rebuilding of the Nauvoo Temple serves as a profound reminder that God's work continues. His promises are sure. A new dawn has risen on the Mississippi, a dawn that signifies a restoration of all things, a dawn which shines from the Lord's house of covenants. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
Amen.